Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Up top here, we're chatting with Justin Savakis. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Zach. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I could be better, I got to admit.
It's been a rough week for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's tough times.
You more than a lot.
And not because of the preview guide. Like, I've just got shit going on in my personal life that I won't get into, but the preview guide's happening right now, and it's actually not that stressful this time. The season is kind of mellow. Like, it's not a giant dump of shows. There's like one or two every day. Some days there's only one. Some days there's three. But everyone's really slow to simulcast now. They're like, they announce it like the day of or the day before.
Right. And there's also, I noticed that a lot of the shows are very staggered. Like, it's probably a good 2 or 3 weeks that everything is rolling out over.
Yeah, we'll be finished on the 13th.
Is that when Ungo comes out?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. Because there's only one show after that's on like the 15th. But I think that's Ungo, yeah. And okay. Someone will probably announce it, you know, 15 hours before it airs or an hour before it airs or something.
Right.
I guess that's the style. Is it just like that's how the contracts are? Or that's they've decided that's the way to do it?
Yeah, well, basically no one wants to – everyone drags their feet as much as possible because, A, in Japan everyone's still stressed because everything is – things still aren't 100% normal post-earthquake.
Right.
So everybody is just kind of weighing their options, seeing how much they can get for these shows. On the licensee side, they just, you know, everything's very last minute. It's like South Park. I mean, the show doesn't even finish up until the last minute. And, you know, the licensing takes way longer than even production does sometimes.
Yeah. It's a little frustrating, but at the same time, like, I've got my established set of rules and I can work with what they're doing. Like, you know, they announce something after we've already reviewed it because it didn't have a license. So I'll go back and add the streaming links. You know, it's not that tough. But yeah, I don't know. For whatever reason, it's pretty laid back. And we'll get to the shows themselves in a little bit. But first, I wanted to talk about movies. So I finally saw Drive. I dragged my feet for some reason, but I finally saw it. And
what do you think of it?
Well, I liked it. I didn't like it as much as I thought I would, and I liked the first 45 minutes much more than the last 45 minutes. Those first like 45 minutes in the introduction, the opening scene, great. Like, I was like, I'm gonna love this. And then like an hour into it, I was like, I'm gonna like this. So it was good, but
what happened? I don't quite get it.
I feel like the story after the whole Christina Hendricks thing.
Right.
For whatever reason, I felt like, okay, where is this really going? And is it too airy? Is it too atmosphere? Is it too just atmosphere? And I kind of walked away with it saying, yeah, that was mostly just atmosphere, which is neat for a short film, but for an entire movie, I was a little,
It's true. It's more style than substance. That, yeah. I don't think anyone's arguing that.
Yeah.
And it didn't really hit me until afterwards, you know, like a lot of people with that kind of taste in music, I went immediately home and downloaded the three vocal songs on iTunes.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah, great,
I was sick of them within 2 days.
Yeah. You do that weird binging thing where you like listen to it on repeat.
Yeah.
And
although yes, I burn out on music quickly. That's fast even for me.
Yeah, it is. I think it's one of those things where it's kind of an exciting movie artistically. But it's sort of also one of those things where, like, I'm not going to buy the Blu-ray. I can't see myself buying it on Blu-ray. Or really wanting to revisit it again until, like, maybe it'll come on cable or something. But it's one of those things where in the moment it's like, wow. And then afterward I was kind of like, meh. It was pretty good.
There's nothing there to analyze.
Yeah, there isn't.
It is exactly what it appears to be. And what it appears to be is a lot of fun in the moment. But it's a roller coaster, and you don't analyze the roller coaster in the weeks afterwards.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the funny thing is, like, Before I saw it, you know, I saw most of Ryan Gosling's talk show appearances, at least on the talk shows I watch, Conan and Jimmy Fallon. And he tells the story of how he wasn't getting along with the director at all, and he was basically driving him home, and they'd sort of decided not to do the movie. And some song came on, some 80s pop song, and the director just comes to life and goes, "This is it! This is the movie! So a guy drives around Los Angeles listening to music!" And it's like, that's the movie! Yeah, pretty much.
I do like that it showed L.A. in all of its scumminess, because usually we get a very false look at what this town is like, and this is a shitty town. Yeah,
it is. It's dirty. You know, depending on where you are, it's dirty. The Los Angeles that was presented in it, I felt, was much more realistic, and, you know, I'm one of the few people that thinks Los Angeles is fairly beautiful in its kind of griminess. People bitch about LA being just dirty, and I'm like, well, but it's kind of beautiful in its filth.
I like living here.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's
but
not
at the same time, I just moved away from a neighborhood that had 3 shootings in the last 6 months.
Yeah, you're living in a much nicer place now, so
let's face it, LA, eh.
Yeah, right, and I retreat to the suburbs. I mean, I intentionally don't live there. I live in Orange County.
But
I liked Drive. I would recommend it to film fans. Like, if you're into movies, go see it, because you're going to get something out of it. But if you're not, and you think it's an action movie or something, it's not an action movie.
No.
There's action in it, but that's not the point of the film.
I do have to say that Albert Brooks was an amazing bad guy.
Oh, yeah. Boy, he needs to get more work doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, he's really good at it.
I mean, he's like one of the most respected comedians, comic personalities, just one of the most like revered people by virtually everyone working in film. And I'm surprised I don't see him in more movies.
Well, he always was this very specific character. And I would almost consider his character almost a proto Louis C.K.
Yeah.
In that it's all based on nice guy who just seems to worm himself into situations that the only way out is just mortifyingly embarrassing.
Yeah, maybe also he had like kind of a string of flops for a bit.
Yeah.
There,
so. Oh my God. The what was that one? Comedy in the Muslim World.
Searching for Comedy in the Muslim World, or Looking for Comedy. Yeah. And then The Muse. That was bad.
Oh God.
He's had some bad movies, but
My First Mister.
Yeah. I'd like to see him show up more as like a character actor in those kind of parts. Like, he was really, really good.
I will say though, Defending Your Life is to this day quoted verbatim among my immediate family.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, all of his stuff from the '80s is pretty much flawless, but after that, not so much. Eighties and like early to mid '90s. Drive, check it out if you're a film fan, I would say. Yeah. And the other thing I saw was 50-50, the quote-unquote cancer comedy with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
How was that?
It's excellent. I really liked it. It's very funny, and it's not sentimental. It's touching without being goopy, and it's one of the best movies about sickness that pairs it with levity that I've ever seen. I mean, it's kind of a knockout of the park in terms of what it's trying to do. And it is uplifting, and it's based on a true story about Seth Rogen and his friend who went through cancer. But I highly recommend it. It's very good. I don't know that you'll like it as much as I did. I don't know that your sense of humor is similar enough to mine to where you'd find it funny. But it's not like a stupid comedy or a dumb comedy. It's just a really solid adult film that tells a different side of the whole cancer thing, without being really, really sentimental and sad and just like emotional porn. You know?
Honestly, I was looking forward to it. I do dig that kind of movie. I think where we just diverge on that sort of comedy is a lot of them tend to be coming of age movies, and I don't like any non-miserable coming of age movies, I've decided.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hey, that's a good realization. That's a good distinction to make.
Right? Because, you know, I just if you were happy at all in between the ages of 12 and 22, I don't understand you.
Okay. All right. Yeah, no, that sums it up for you, I think. That's a good way to crystallize that whole thing.
There is my baggage right there, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Yeah. But that's kind of it. Other than that, a whole bunch of catalog stuff came out on Blu-ray lately. The most significant of which being Pulp Fiction, which I hadn't seen in about 5 years, but that movie pretty much was high school for me. Like, I'm pretty sure I wore out my VHS of it in high school. And it came out when I was 14, and I had sort of lenient parents, so they let me see it. And I was obsessed with it in high school, and of course, you know, all my friends were as well, and then I watched it a lot through college and everything, so I have the whole thing memorized. Like, I can tell you every line of that movie, and every shot and everything. But I haven't seen it in about 5 years. And I got the Blu-ray, and I watched it yesterday, and it really, I feel like that movie has been so memorized by pop culture and just culture in general that you don't ever need to watch it again. Like, if you've seen it, you never need to see it again, because you know every single beat, even if you've only seen it once or twice.
Citizen Kane syndrome, I call that.
Yeah, there you go. Right, exactly. In terms of, like, movies that have just been memorized by culture and referenced and quoted and parodied, etc., so many times, over and over and over again, that it's just, it's part of the cultural fabric, and you don't really need to watch it unless you haven't seen it. And if you haven't seen it and you sit down and watch it, you're going to recognize everything in it.
Yeah, nothing will come as a surprise anymore.
Yeah. I'm glad I have it. It looks great. I'll put it away for 10 years this time.
For that reason, I'm actually kind of looking forward to watching Jackie Brown.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's
because,
like,
I only
bucks.
Saw bits and pieces of it the first time around.
Yeah, that's my least favorite Tarantino movie. But it's coming from Amazon at some point here.
I have a feeling it's the only thing that, you know, from that era of Tarantino where he was just so mainstream and so everywhere and so parodied, it might be the only one that's still fresh.
Yeah, that's probably a theory, at least. That's probably a good point. I mean, everyone hated Death Proof except me and, like, two other guys.
I like Death Proof. I don't think I could watch it again.
It's a frequent pop it in while I'm cleaning the house or whatever movie for me.
Do you skip the inane conversation?
I love that part. I love all that stuff.
Really?
That's my favorite part of Tarantino movies, are the languid conversations. I love it. For some reason, it just, I don't know why. It's like candy to me. It's so just like, I feel relaxed somehow. You know, it's like Kill Bill Volume 2 is my favorite. I like it much more than the first one. And it's mostly people talking.
I love the Kill Bill movies. I think that's my favorite Tarantino. To be honest, I like Tarantino. I don't love Tarantino. I think it's because I have an anti-foot fetish.
Yeah. Although it's funny because in the documentaries on the Pulp Fiction, because they made a new documentary that just has the cast sort of reminiscing about making the film. And John Travolta looks really old now, but
yeah,
he
really does.
He does. He sounds old too. Like, he's got a quiver in his voice. But one of the actors was commenting on how, like, well, you know, and it's amazing because we were there at the beginning and you've just seen him grow and change so much. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. I love Quentin Tarantino. I love his movies. I love his self-indulgent. He's the kind of guy where if you like his thing, you like his thing. And if you don't, you don't. But growth and change are not two things I would use to describe the career of Quentin Tarantino. He makes the same shit over and over and over again.
And he's very good at it.
He's very good at that shit, but you have to like that. And, you know, Inglourious Basterds was as much of a step forward as you could possibly expect from him. And it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. He's like one of my other favorite directors, Wes Anderson. Kind of makes the same thing over and over again. Either you like it or you don't. But, yeah, anyway. But yeah, other than that, not a lot, just anime. So anything on your end? Or?
Yeah, not a lot. My last week was taken up with moving and, you know, all of the stuff that comes with it. But there were a couple big things. The first was my music video finally came out.
Oh, yeah.
That I got to direct. And it's gotten a pretty good reception. People are either really depressed by it or laugh at it, and very little in between, and very little negativity on the video itself. So it means I won.
Congratulations. That's good.
Thank you. So aside from that, not a whole lot, because all my DVDs were packed up for the last week. So all I could really pull out and manage to pop in was Streets of Fire.
Again.
And I had to reauthor that because that was the first thing that I rebuilt, and the only thing that I rebuilt from HD DVD into a Blu-ray. And there were technical problems that I didn't know about at the time, and it no longer worked, so I had to redo that. But that movie is not good.
But you love it. I mean, you know,
I do.
There's a lot of I love a lot of bad movies. Speaking of HD DVD, I just threw away what would have been at retail something like $400 worth of them.
And now at retail would be like 30 cents.
30 cents, yeah. Because I looked online, I'm like, there's no way I can actually unload these, can I? Nope. No. Into the dumpster. Some hobo will be really happy to have a copy of The Big Lebowski on HD DVD.
We're finally at the point where almost everything that was on HD DVD is completely redundant with Blu-ray. Almost.
I think I may have... No, I don't think I've got any left. I had one that I bought a movie that I, for some reason, decided I wanted in the moment, and I think it came out on Blu-ray, but I just tossed it, and I'm not going to rebuy it. I think pretty much everything else is out. I don't think there was anything that's that they're holding back at this point. Just Streets of Fire. I'm kind of surprised that's not out yet.
I'm not. Nobody bought that.
I don't know. It's kind of a little bit of a cult hit. Cult classic.
A little bit, but more in Japan than here. And the only reason I even am interested in it is because it's been ripped off by Bubblegum Crisis and Zillion and is referenced in Megazone.
Do they ever run that at like the New Beverly? You ever see that there?
Streets of Fire? No,
For some reason I could swear I heard about some kind of an anniversary screening or something. In the last 5 years, but I guess I'm misremembering.
Speaking of reissues, though, I'm really excited for Friday, because that's when the Giorgio Moroder 80s Pop Metropolis comes out.
Friday, really?
Yeah.
That's weird. Why are they releasing it on Friday? Is this a theatrical?
Yeah, a theatrical.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. I thought the Blu-ray was coming out. Isn't it out in, like, November?
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, they're doing a limited theatrical of it in HD, and it's playing at my favorite theater, the Cine Family. It's marginally worth going there over driving to San Diego.
Yeah, you may as well just suffer.
I know, but it's worth it, and it's one of my most formative childhood viewing experiences. So
cool. Yeah, that's...
There I will go.
Speaking of formative childhood viewing experiences, I saw The Lion King 3D.
still love it?
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's extremely compact. That movie feels like it's 15 minutes long because it's so efficiently scripted. It is literally just boom, 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 end. And it's still funny and exciting and good. And I think it's probably... I mean, you know, everyone points to Beauty and the Beast, but I think... Lion King, upon revisiting it, I think it might be their best from the 90s, from the early 90s, from the Renaissance period.
I still want to, I do kind of want to revisit that, because just, I remember there being a few shots, and you'll probably know exactly what I'm talking about, that just give you goosebumps.
Yeah, there's a lot. That whole movie, I mean, the story of that film is that it kind of had the B team working on it, because at the time, Disney was convinced Pocahontas was going to be their next huge smash, and Lion King was kind of the side thing. They're like, all right, well, who wants to work on the animal movie? And they got a couple of recruits from sort of the A team, but it was mostly junior varsity working on it. And you can kind of tell the animation is very simple. There's not a lot of shading. There's some line thickness issues and some mistakes that they never corrected. But it's then went on to become the highest grossing animated film of all time. And then they re-released it and it was number one for 2 weeks and it's probably going to hit 100 million.
Holy shit.
People fucking love that movie.
And it's endless cash cow.
Yeah. Not to mention it's huge in Mexico, like massive.
Really?
Yeah. Huge in South America, to the point where they advertise, like, there's a sticker on the Blu-ray that just came out that said, like, there's Spanish on here. It was huge down there. So yeah, made a shitload of money. People really love that movie, me included.
I had that, you know, stupid springy plastic VHS version.
Yeah,
that would inevitably chip and you would cut yourself on.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the Blu-ray does look very nice. Like, it's a color wise it's a very pretty pretty movie. So if you you know, rent it or something, I would say it's worth a revisit. You will probably enjoy it, and it's a short movie. It's barely, it's like 80 minutes.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it's short, and it goes by very quick, as I said. So worth your time.
I saw it so many times, I probably can recite it as I watch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, man, me too. I have it memorized. I couldn't believe it, because I hadn't seen it in a little while. Not since the original DVD came out, like 4 or 5 years ago. And I was sitting there in the theater, and all I knew every single line of the film.
you know what? Actually, I used to be a huge fan of it, but what killed it for me is that my mom wanted to go to see the Broadway musical.
Oh, yeah, the Julie Taymor thing.
Yeah, which, you know...
That's all right.
I just hate musical theater.
Really?
I'm not a musical theater fan.
Well, you like musicals, just not musical theater.
Right. I think it's just the I'm not a play guy.
You don't,
I think,
like stage it. People,
right? And I know too many stage actors and want to push them all down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, there is that. I get kind of annoyed just walking into a theater,
right? And so I just sat there watching these people in these, you know, amazing but ridiculous costumes.
Yeah.
And just sitting there thinking, well, I know every line of this play. The costumes were interesting for the first 5 minutes, and now I'm just kind of waiting for something new to happen, and it will not.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I took away most from that is that as a kid, you know, I think I was 14 when that movie came out, but I was a cartoon nerd, so I kind of had to be stealth about that movie. Like, I couldn't really tell my friends, oh man, Lion King's fucking great, I'm gonna go see it for the fifth time or whatever. That was something I had to keep to myself, because didn't want to be the weird 15-year-old who was really into cartoons still. But I had the Image album. They released an Image album for that, and all the music, all the extra music in the stage version is from that album. And I hadn't heard those songs in 10 years or whatever, so I was happy to, I was like, oh, I remember this song, like, it's from that weird Image CD that it's not it wasn't particularly easy to find when it came out and was sort of obscure. So that was kind of the best part of that for me. But the weird, like, double head thing where you see the actor's face and they're just wearing like a lion head on their head, it's just weird.
Yeah.
And I like Julie Taymor. I like Julie Taymor. I think she's artistically kind of a genius visually anyway. You know, that's her strength, is visual art. But,
well, apparently you missed your litmus test.
I guess so. But anyway, we should talk a little bit about anime.
Yep.
So this season has started, and I've been very busy, so I haven't gotten to watch a lot of stuff, but of the stuff I've seen, the theme, I really liked two of them. I liked the new Hunter x Hunter. Did you watch that?
No, I'm actually looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's very, it seems to break down as, if you care that much about the original show, things about this one will bother you, and if you don't care, you're going to like it. It's truncated. The story's truncated, and they're getting through it faster, but that didn't...
Well, that's fine. The original was very slow.
Well, yeah. From what I remember of it, yeah. But
this, very slow.
This goes right... skips right along, and it's action-packed, and the animation's pretty nice, and the music is nice, and it was quality production. I liked it.
Is anyone simulcast out?
Crunchyroll. Okay. So you can catch it on Crunchyroll, and it's worth it. And Fibrain, which is not being simulcast, is the goofiest fucking thing I've seen in a really long time, but it's very entertaining. Super goofy.
It looks, well, I mean, what was that line? I won't forgive people who toy with other people's lives using puzzles.
That is not as goofy as the solve all the puzzles, solve them all, set them free.
What?
He flashed, at one point, he's like, or his, like, the super puzzle solver guy, his, like, plucky female sidekick, who's like, why are you so compelled to solve all these puzzles? And he flashes back briefly to, like, silhouettes of what I assume are family members or friends or something, saying, like, you're so great when you're solving puzzles. And then the next guy goes, solve them, solve all the puzzles. Yeah, it's super goofy. Like, you can't take it seriously for even a second. But
have they introduced the guy yet whose head looks like a dandelion?
No.
When I was doing the anime spotlight feature, there's this one character that just has the most hilariously shaped head I've ever seen in anime, and is still supposed to be cool.
You know, the spotlight tells you way more that's in the pilot episode.
Oh.
Like, I was looking at the spotlight, and I was preparing to write my synopsis, because I write my previews as I'm watching the show. Mm-hmm. And then amend as it goes along. And I sort of started writing a synopsis, and it included some information from the spotlight, and they don't even get into some of that stuff. Like, the last half of the spotlight synopsis is not in the pilot. So, interesting. But, yeah. Hey,
we just go with what we're given by the Japanese.
Yeah, you want to know more about that story, check out the spotlight. But the animation's good. Yeah, it's just goofy. I don't know if I'm going to, you know, dutifully watch it every week, but I liked it. And then after that, the theme this year seems to be boring. Lots of boring shows. Kimi ni Boku or Kimi to Boku.
Right.
Whatever it's called.
Kimi to Boku.
Kimi to Boku. I was just sitting there, like, head in hands, like, face melting off. I was so bored. Like, I was so boring. Why would they make a show about those guys? Like, it's just these four high school dullards.
Because it's supposed to give you time to glance down and draw them boning each other.
Well, no, but yeah, and then everyone was saying, like, well, Noah ran in a shonen magazine, but they flirt a little bit with each other.
Oh, yeah, because there is no yaoi fans reading Shonen Jump.
Yeah, exactly. People are very desperate to, like, categorize things. And when you categorize something falsely or they think you're doing it wrong, they're rushing to tell you, no, but actually it's the, yeah, so... I mean, there's yaoi overtones, but the character designs aren't particularly salacious or, like, even very attractive. They're just kind of normal-looking anime dudes with sort of mop-headed teenagers without strong features or anything. They're just sort of all wearing similar clothes, and it's all very boring. There's a really girly one that, for some reason, is really, really girly and looks kind of like a girl, and they, like, brush his hair and stuff. No yaoi overtones in that.
None.
But, yeah, it's just so boring. And, like, I could understand if there was something interesting about these people. But there isn't. There's nothing interesting about them. Like, they've been friends since preschool or whatever. And the show, it's like they walked into a high school and they picked, like, the table of kids who don't stand out. They're all, like, B students. And they get by in high school by not being noticed. And then they're like, let's make a show about these guys. And it's like, yeah, I'm sure they have really uninteresting in-jokes and go home and do their homework and watch TV and go to sleep, but that's not interesting. These people aren't interesting.
Can't wait for the episode where one of them goes on Accutane.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Then maybe it'll liven up while he, you know, tries to kill everyone.
Yeah, god damn, it was boring. But then after that was another show that was... slice of life, slow moving, but I didn't hate it. I didn't think it was boring. It had sort of an emotional hook to it, where little girl's father recently passed away, and he was a shutterbug, like a photographer, and so she sort of takes up his camera hobby as a sort of a coping mechanism. And the whole thing is very slow, but the at least the father thing, like, that's something interesting about that character. And it is, you know, her mother's dealing with the grief, and there's something happening there emotionally. So I guess just, like, in comparison to Kimi to Boku, I was like, oh, this isn't that bad, because they could have been that other show where fucking nothing was going on. So I guess I was in a little bit of staggering around at that point in shock from the boredom. But there's a few things left this season, but pretty overall, nothing to get excited about, nothing that blew my hair back so far. Obviously, we're only about halfway through it, a little less than halfway through it. But even looking at what's coming up, kind of a weak fall season, I would say.
That is kind of unusual, but I guess not all that unexpected.
No. So before we go, I did want to ask, the anime spotlights, can people expect more next time?
Oh yeah, a huge hit. The producers are happy. We're basically just trying to get more producers on board now. So if you ever are at a con or you have any interaction with any of the companies that we worked with, please let them know that you appreciated it, because any positive feedback we can get only helps us do more of them.
Awesome. All right. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get to the guest.
Hell yeah!
Okay, we're back. My guest this week is the author of Satoshi Kon, The Illusionist, and the BFI book on Spirited Away. He's also the author of the recent 100 Animated Feature Films, which is 100 Animated Feature Films. And he's also a new addition to the ANN staff. He's Anime News Network's UK news editor. It's Andrew Osmond. Hey, Andrew, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
No problem. So let's start at the top. I'm not particularly familiar with your career and life as a fan, I guess. When did you first get into anime? How did it find you? And yeah, tell us that story.
Okay, well, I got into anime at the same time as a lot of British people got into anime, which was with the limited cinema release of Akira, which was, I think, back in 1991, 92, there were a lot of... It never got a big cinema release in Britain, but a lot of individual cinemas showed it around the country. And if I remember rightly, my younger brother dragged me out to see it. And like a lot of other people who've seen Akira, I was blown away and very impressed. I mean, the thing about Akira that strikes me is that it's the kind of thing that you watch and you think it's part of something bigger. I mean, it's one of these films that, I mean, big though it is, it's you sense that, there's something bigger behind it. There's a bigger story and a bigger industry behind it. And that's one thing, I think, which immediately fascinated a lot of people. And so... Yep, I saw Akira in the cinema, and then over the next few months, I caught the film at cinema screenings in other places, and at the same time, I began to read magazine articles by the relatively few really in-the-know, keyed-up people in Britain who were already writing about anime, which includes people like Helen McCarthy and Jonathan Clements and people like Jim Swallow and Jim McLennan and lots of others. There was already a kind of semi-pro scene, I think, called Anime UK, which later became a full-fledged magazine. This was long before I was writing about anime myself, but that kind of journalism was a big influence on me from the start. I should add that, like a lot of British viewers, I had seen anime before on TV without realising it was anime. In Britain, the kinds of shows we got were things like Marine Boy, which actually I didn't see, but then there was Battle of the Planets, which of course is the Americanized version of Gatchaman. And then in the 80s, we got some TV shows that I think are less known in America. Things like Ulysses 31 and Mysterious Cities of Gold, which were both collaborations between Japan and France. So by the time Akira rolls around, British people had actually seen a fair bit of anime, but we had no idea what it was until Akira.
Yeah, well, Akira is definitely the, that's true on both sides of the pond, I guess. That exploded here as well. Yeah. And we did have Mysterious Cities of Gold, and it is kind of a nostalgia touchstone for American fans because it ran on Nickelodeon in the 80s and through the 90s. So we had that. But Ulysses 31, I know I've heard of it, but I'm sure I have never seen it. Justin?
I think it was one of those shows that just got a little bit of U.S. syndication, but didn't really get any steam. We had Marine Boy, of course.
Yeah, right.
Briefly, Ulysses 31 is simply a sci-fi reworking of the Odyssey. So in this version, Ulysses is on a spaceship. He's the captain of a spaceship. He again offends the Greek gods who send him to another universe, which he has to try to get out of. There are also some kids and a robot who most people find very, very annoying. But it is some of the best episodes are kind of very surreal and very vivid. And also it has a great opening theme tune. And for those reasons, it's quite well remembered by British viewers of my generation.
I see. Well, in the post-Akira era, who was the immediate fan base? Because I can only go by Manga UK tapes that were released at the time, and from the looks of it, they were kind of trying to attract the skater crowd, the kind of raucous teen audience. Was that who was actually watching it?
I'm not an expert on that. So, I mean, there are other people better qualified to answer that than me. I mean, certainly, yes. I think it's fair to say that manga, yes, they were trying to attract an audience of, I suppose, older teenagers who would be into kind of action films, quite violent action in places, and also into science fiction. My memories of the early fan events, yeah, I mean, we were getting a lot of people from that demographic. But at the same time, there were other people coming in. For example, female fans who were, I think they were reading the articles, and they were deliberately trying to go. They were immediately trying to go deep into the subjects and trying to find out about series that weren't being released in Britain and types of anime that weren't becoming available in Britain. I mean, there were ways of finding out. So I remember, even I think when I was at university, I think around the time Akira was first released, I remember just meeting an American fan and talking with him about anime, and obviously he was reeling off titles that I had either only heard vaguely about or had never heard about at all, because obviously I think in those days American fandom was already far more developed than British fandom.
So eventually you decided to get into this professionally. Were you starting a different career and then anime came along and you decided to combine the two, which is kind of what happened to me, or did you attempt to launch your career knowing from the outset you wanted to write about anime?
Nearly. I mean, really the point is that I think the writer Jonathan Clements once pointed out that a lot of people get into Japanese animation because it's Japanese, because it reflects this very fascinating Japanese culture. For me, I'm different. I was fascinated by anime, I suppose, mainly because it was animated, and I already had a kind of interest in animation, and especially in animated films. I was already reading histories of the Disney Studio, for example, and things like that. At the same time, I had always liked reading magazines, and I always enjoyed writing at school. I always, you know, really wanted to try to write professionally, and so yes, I mean, that's, I kind of drifted into writing initially in a very small way, and some of my writing was about animation and about anime. In the early years, I wrote for magazines like, some of them don't exist now, things like Animato, which was published in America, and also later for Animerica itself.
You know, that's a really interesting point that you bring up about being an animation fan that then found anime and was naturally attracted to it for that reason. I'm exactly the same way. I didn't get into anime because it was Japanese or it was foreign or anything like that. I was a big cartoon nerd my whole life, like growing up, and I found anime, and it was a natural fit because I wanted stuff that was more mature. I wanted stuff that felt different. I was a huge Disney fan, like massive fan of Disney, but anime came along and it was this big breath of fresh air. But the cultural thing was not the attraction for me. But that's interesting. I don't know. I don't meet a lot of people who did come into it from that perspective. Most of the people that I know definitely came into it because, oh, this is Japanese. The culture is so interesting, and look at this cultural artifact that they've got. And yeah, that's cool. I didn't know about that. I mean, how would you describe your entry, Justin? I mean,
well, I was kind of halfway between the two. I mean, I got into it. It attracted my eye because it was weird.
Yeah.
But I was already into, like, for example, I used to love the alternative animation, like those festivals of animation that used to not so much Spike and Mike's, but like International Tyranny of Animation and Animation Celebration.
Right.
You know, those that used to make the rounds in the art house scene. So, yeah, to go to Blockbuster and suddenly see these weird cartoons that were that had nudity and you needed your parents' permission to rent, I was like, what is this?
Wow, yeah.
I should add that, so I think even before I saw Akira, one of the films I did see and was intrigued by was Warriors of the Winds, which I which is the cutdown version of Miyazaki's Nausicaa, which I remember seeing. Or it was released on video in Britain, I think, before Akira. And so I remember seeing it and thinking, hey, this looks really good, but the story seems a bit choppy in places. And I later found out why that was the case. The one point of interest, of course, is that in the 1980s, there was a film called When the Wind Blows, which was by a Japanese director, Jimmy Murakami, which is basically a British produced film about a nuclear holocaust in Britain, based on a comic strip by Raymond Briggs. So, I mean, that was a kind of early foretaste of anime, I suppose.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think I've ever... I know I've heard of that, but I don't think I've ever actually seen it.
Yeah, same here. Although Warriors of the Wind was quite prominent on HBO here in the mid-80s. And yeah. I think even in chopped up form, it was plainly obvious that it was something special.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was your first opportunity to write? Where you know, when did that bug hit you? Where'd you get your first like paid gig?
I'm trying to remember. It's hard to remember now, to be honest. It's, it probably was on Animato magazine, which was in the mid-90s, which was a magazine about animation in general, with some and some of the coverage was of anime. And then later it was things like there was a British science fiction magazine which began in the mid-90s, which was called SFX. It's not to be confused with I think there was an American magazine of the same name, which is more specifically about special effects. The British SFX is basically a magazine about I suppose fantasy media, science fiction and fantasy media, and it's still going today. And in fact, I still freelance for it as a reviewer. So really, SFX is one of my longest, not quite tenuous, but certainly kinds of relationships. It's a magazine to which I owe a great deal, and they and these days, in fact, they do sometimes release special issue magazines devoted to anime.
Huh. Well, you're lucky they're still in business, I guess.
Yes, I am.
That's cool.
Has the British magazine scene been hit by the decline in print media as much as ours has?
Again, I'm not the person to speak to. I think from what I've heard, I certainly believe it has been. Whether it's the same extent as America, I just don't know.
Well, so your first book was forgive me if I have these backwards, but your first book was the BFI book on Spirited Away, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how did that come about? What spurned that? Did you see the movie and it blew your mind and you're like, I got to write about this? Did the opportunity just sort of come around? I mean, how did that get started?
Okay. Well, I had a connection with the BFI because I've been writing for a film magazine called Sight and Sounds, which is a film review criticism magazine published by the BFI, the British Film Institute, and the BFI has for decades it's been publishing a long series of small books, each of which is about a particularly outstanding film, anything really from the Terminator to The Seventh Seal, done by a great range of writers. I'd been a Miyazaki fan really since the early 90s, because I should say that after Akira, one of the next big anime events that I went to was in about 1992 at a London cinema, which it showed a number of anime films, some of which had not been released on British video at this time, including some Miyazaki films. It showed Kiki's Delivery Service, it showed My Neighbor Totoro, it showed Laputa. And immediately I just saw these films and thought, you know, they were wonderful. And so I became a fan of Miyazaki. I found out things about him through sources like the website, the Nausicaa.net. And so Miyazaki was not well known in Britain for a while. There was a limited release of Princess Mononoke in the late 90s, which got some interest in the media and some good reviews. But then there was Spirited Away, and I think it was the same thing in America. Suddenly, you know, you had some people going to Spirited Away, having their minds blown. You had rave write-ups in the British press. You had film reviewers falling over themselves to say, this is great, this is brilliant. I mean, I was in the, like a lot of other people, by this time I was in the position of kind of a relatively old-time fan. I mean, I'm not sure whether Spirited Away is Miyazaki's greatest film. I can certainly see the case being made for things like Laputa and My Neighbor Totoro. But I suppose writing the book on Spirited Away, I suppose there was a certain mercenary element within it, simply in that Spirited Away was the film that obviously a lot of British people would know. A lot of British people has fallen in love with Miyazaki through the film. And certainly I think that Spirited Away is a very good, a very vivid, a very interesting film. And also by writing about Spirited Away, of course that would I would need to explain the context of it, which would give me the excuse to write about all of the previous films that Miyazaki had directed before then. And so for all of these reasons, I simply pitched the idea of Spirited Away to the BFI, and very kindly they accepted, and that's how I wrote it.
All right, so you mentioned Miyazaki's, you know, filmography, and I mean, personally, do you have, like, a favorite, and do you think there's one that's objectively his best?
That's a good distinction. Yes, I suppose my personal favorite is probably Laputa, which I just think is so much fun, and I just love the way that the kind of the world opens out through the film. You start in this small village, which is actually, I found out later, it was partly modeled on Wales, which Miyazaki's visited, and it then just opens out, and I love the way that really at the beginning of the film there's no forewarning of what the world of Laputa will be like when you get there, and then you get there and it surpasses your expectations, I think. I do still remember the experience of watching Laputa the first time, which for me was nearly 20 years ago. Objectively, the best film, it may well be My Neighbor Totoro, which a lot of people argue for. I can see the cases being made for most of Miyazaki's films. Kiki's Delivery Service is obviously a wonderful starting point if you're first getting into Miyazaki, and again, it's a great film. But I would say my personal favourite is Laputa. I'm also extremely fond of Future Boy Conan, which is Miyazaki's 1970s TV series, which actually foreshadows Laputa in a number of ways.
Well, yeah, for sure. All those comparisons. I've seen, like, those comparison videos where, you know, they're very similar. But I actually disagree with both of your choices. My personal favourite is Nausicaa, and I think his best, objectively, like, this is the ultimate Miyazaki movie, is Mononoke. Just because it's kind of a perfected version of... It's a better film than Nausicaa is, telling pretty much the same, kind of the same story. It's a similar story. But I think it's his best film, just, like, overall. And I find myself going with the people who now find Spirited Away kind of dull. I don't know. What about you, Justin?
I tend to agree with you, Zach, although I'm tossed up between for personal for overall best, I might like Porco Rosso the best. I think it's the most mature and measured out of all of his stories, and also I think probably has the most to say about the world. Yeah. A lot of Miyazaki stuff gets kind of heavy-handed with the environmental message, and after a while it's like, okay, we get it.
Okay, just as a brief point, actually, I mean, I certainly see the arguments for both Nausicaa and Princess Mononoke, which are both great films. Although I would say that when it comes to Miyazaki's kinds of epic, his world-building epics, for me, the definitive is always going to be the manga version of Nausicaa of the Valley of Winds, which I think, for me at least, I think it surpasses both the film version of Nausicaa and even Princess Mononoke.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. The manga, the Nausicaa manga, is the best thing he's ever made. Like, period. You read okay. that? It's a masterpiece. But yeah, I wish we could get a fully animated version of that. But we've talked about that on the show.
Yeah.
So you did the Spirited Away book, and then up next was Satoshi Kon.
Yes.
Sort of an obvious jump there from one sort of master artist to the next. Did Kon's stuff leap out to you immediately? When did you get to the point where you're like, I got to write about this guy?
Right. So again, here I have a confession to make. I saw Perfect Blue pretty early, and Perfect Blue grew on me. The first time I saw it, I wasn't really quite sure what to make of it, and I certainly did not fully understand it the first time. I've seen it many times since then, and it has grown on me considerably. And to be honest, I was late getting into a lot of other Satoshi Kon material because the DVD releases of Millennium Actress and Tokyo Godfathers only got to Britain, I think, quite late and long after the American releases. Actually, Paranoia Agent, I suppose, when I saw the opening episodes of that was... which was obviously much later. That was the first time where I really started thinking, wow, you know, this guy, you know, you know, there's something big going on with this guy. And I have to confess that, to be honest, the idea of writing a Satoshi Kon book, it was actually suggested to me by the good, by actually the great Julie Davis, who is obviously the former editor of An America magazine. And she suggested to me the idea of writing about Satoshi Kon. This was just after the release of Paprika, of course, which I had the luck to go to the Venice Film Festival to see that, and I thought it was great fun. And so for me, it was the writing about it. It was the opportunity of really going into Satoshi Kon and trying to clarify what I thought about it and trying to understand it properly and as fully as I could do. I still don't think I understand Satoshi Kon at all fully, but certainly writing the book was my opportunity to understand him a lot better than I did. And so, yeah, I mean, the book was commissioned by Julie Davis and by Peter Goodman of Stonebridge Press. And I try... as I think I say in the book, I very much models it on the previous Stonebridge Press book about Hayao Miyazaki, which was written by Helen McCarthy. And so the book goes through, obviously, Satoshi Kon's early career. It goes through his five major anime, Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, Paranoid Agents, Tokyo Godfathers, Paprika, and Also, I had the great luck that I was in Tokyo in 2007, and I requested an interview with Satoshi Kon at the Mazo studio, and very, very kindly they said yes, and so I was able to interview Satoshi Kon in 2007, which obviously makes the book, I think, a lot better than it would have been otherwise.
You know, that must have been, I mean, that must have been a big challenge. Like, writing that book must have been really, maybe it wasn't, but to me it sounds an incredibly daunting task to write that book.
It was daunting, yes.
Because I get intimidated by something like a Satoshi Kon movie, because I sit down and I'm like, this guy's a genius, who am I? Like, I'm going to write about his movie? Like, what am I going to have to say that's insightful? Like, that's the kind of movie where, as a writer, as a critic, I think, like, I need to bring my A game and try to be insightful about this amazing thing. And it's tough. Like, it's not easy to write about that stuff. So
it is tough. I mean, I had to, I had to write and rewrite a lot and reread and try to say, is this really good enough? And am I really getting to the important stuff? Back when Perfect Blue was released, I got into a few of the kinds of internet discussions and arguments about the film by people coming to it from different sides, including people who thought that it was overrated or offensive or whatever. So I actually went back to the internet groups and looked at some of the arguments again, and I tried to read around what other people had said about Kon, and obviously I watched the films again and just tried to ask myself, what do I think about this? And obviously with at least with the earlier work like Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress, there is more distance now. There's at least been some time to digest the earlier films, and obviously to some extent as well the later work puts the earlier work in context. For example, Perfect Blue, a lot of people took this as being a kind of attack and condemnation on the otaku and the obsessed fan and the people who live in fantasy worlds, and perhaps it is all these things, but then you look at films like Millennium Actress and Paprika, which also have kinds of otaku figures or obsessive fans, but they're actually far more positive, even lovable figures, and you get the feeling that the works are being balanced against each other, and that obviously gives you something else to write about. The fact that the kind of cumulative ethos, the message of Satoshi Kon's work is not obvious just from watching, say, Perfect Blue or Paranoid Agents in isolation.
Right, yeah. And it just sounds, again, it sounds like an incredibly difficult thing to parse all this stuff and figure out how to write it in a coherent way. I don't know. That seems incredibly challenging to me. So you did that, and now you're working for us.
Yes.
Doing our news for the UK site. And I'm sort of curious, how has that experience been for you so far?
It is still a learning process. Yes, it is intimidating. I mean, obviously, ANN has such a high reputation. I hope that I can live up to it. Trying to sift through the news and collect the news, I am becoming more aware of obviously what's going on in the UK scene, about what the main issues are about local distribution. You become more aware of stories like, for example, a recent story. You may be aware that back in August there was trouble in London. There was rioting in London, which, among other things, there was a warehouse that was destroyed. It was burned up, and unfortunately that contained a lot of discs belonging to a British distributor, which a British anime distributor, which then had to face a major kind of business setback. So you become more aware of the issues around Blu-ray and the expense of Blu-ray and the and particularly the problems about whether you can release a long series on the formats like Blu-ray, whether the sales will justify the costs. Sifting through the news, I've become more aware of the kinds of nuts and bolts issues around the anime industry in my own country.
Yeah, so you kind of have to broaden your focus, like, a lot.
Indeed.
Like, a lot.
Yes.
That's cool. All right. The other thing I kind of wanted to get to was I was told, that you have very strong opinions on both Eden of the East and Summer Wars. And I'm curious to hear about this, because I didn't know that, and Justin and I are both fans of both of those. And I guess starting with Summer Wars, what is your infamous take on this thing?
I'm sorry. To be honest, I'm afraid I may have been misreported. I'm very sorry, but I've written very enthusiastic reviews about both of those titles, both of which I think are excellent titles, and my personal favorites of recent years. But as far as I know, that's hardly a very controversial position.
Yeah,
to
right.
Take.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid that you may have been misinformed. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I've been very enthusiastic about both titles, but I hardly think that's upset anything very controversial about them. Last year I had the luck to be able to interview Mr. Kenji Kamiyama about Eden of the East, and some of the things he said were very interesting. For example, he was talking about how with both Eden of the East and Standalone Complex, both of which revolve around these kinds of revolutionary outsider figures, he was talking about how he was influenced both by things like Catch in the Rye, obviously, which is referred to in Standalone Complex, but also some historical events such as a particular teenage boy who notoriously he assassinated, I think it was the leader of the Japanese Socialist Party in the 1960s, and why this boy did it. Apparently Kamiyama became fascinated with these kinds of figures, and they were an influence on the kinds of revolutionaries that you get in Standalone Complex and indeed in Eden of the East.
So the big thing that we've kind of been talking about lately is the Eden of the East movies,
yes,
which I still have not seen, but Justin recently opined on the last one. On the last show, and I'm curious if you've seen them and what your take on the films is.
Briefly, I've only seen the films once through each, so I haven't fully digested them yet. They're old films. They are different from the TV series. I mean, the TV series is just great fun. I mean, as a serial, it's great fun because there are all these outrageous developments on top of outrageous developments, and all these little parodies and homages of movies, including the news Dawn of the Dead climax in the shopping mall. The films are different. They're not... to put it bluntly, they're not so much fun, which is not to say that they're failures. They are more King of Eden. I mean, like a lot of people, I was disappointed when I first saw King of Eden, which was the first film, even though I could see that Kamiyama was doing something very interesting in that he was really showing how the world in Eden of the East was changing because of the events of the TV serial. You know, he was actually showing how the events were having an impact on broader society, which is something that most science fiction and most anime does not do, and so I appreciated that, and I appreciated that the relationship between the main characters seems to be deepening. Now that I've recently seen the second film, Paradise Lost, I think my appreciation for films is going up. I think that Paradise Lost does it fits to some degree with King of Eden, although I think Paradise Lost, it also feels like a separate film. It's doing its own thing. I think Paradise Lost, it does complete the story in a way that I find interesting. I don't want to give too much of it away. It's a film, I think, that asks that when you finish watching it, you come away and reflect on it. Without giving too much away, it's a kind of film where, you know, it seems to be making this statement, but then it adds another thing. There are a number of kinds of things balancing out other things in the last scenes. And particularly, it's like another IT film, The Skycrawlers, in that there is a vital extra scene which comes after the end credits. So if you're watching the film, please wait until after the end credits, because there is another scene which really does kind of affect your understanding of what has gone before. I think this is a film that does kind of reward reflection, and I think I like them. I mean, it is the films take a different tack from the TV series. They're less fun. They're less crowd pleasing. I mean, the ending of Paradise Lost will not please everyone. But I do think it's a good ending. I mean, that is my kind of vague provisional thoughts, which may well be revised when I see the films again. I mean, like the films of Satoshi Kon, I do think they will reward reviewing, and they may reward reviewing in full context. That is, going back and seeing all the films again. Also, as a last point, of course, it's not really a jest about Paradise Lost, but there is a hint. It's kind of made very early in the TV series that the world of Eden of the East may or may not be the same world as Standalone Complex. It may be an earlier version of the same world. There is a big hint which is made at the beginning, I think, of part two, where you there's reference to a plane crash in which you have two survivors. They're meant to be a 6-year-old boy and a girl. If you've seen the second Standalone Complex series, and if you know the background of Major Kusanagi, then that will have a special meaning.
Oh, cool. I actually didn't know that at all. So that's very interesting. I keep meaning to. I don't know if I should rewatch the TV series before jumping into the movies, because it's been a while at this point, but I don't know. All right.
Yes, you should. Yeah. You will be lost.
Okay. No, I mean, I remember, like, I watched that whole thing in an afternoon and absorbed it pretty well. Like, I have the ending and the themes and everything pretty strong in my head, and I remember it. But I don't know. I really did like that show a lot, though. Okay, let's go ahead and get to Twitter. We got some questions for you here. And I think this is a pretty good one. J. Lane Nelson says, I understand it's very early for this, but what do you think Satoshi Kon's artistic legacy likely will be? How will his work impact the medium going forward? I like that question. I will absolutely agree with him that it's way too early to know, because we haven't seen his last movie yet, and it's still, you know, they're still trying to find the financing for it. So, too early to tell, but an interesting question nonetheless. What do you think, Andrew?
Well, it's simply, I mean, obviously, I mean, Satoshi Kon always said that he wanted to do things with anime that were not being done in the mainstream. He wanted to get away from the kind of formulas that he was getting tired of. I mean, he made that very obvious in his interviews. So I think that will inspire other, you know, budding animators and other budding directors particularly, to say to themselves, you know, hey, you know, I can make different, you know, different kinds of films in Japanese animation. I don't have to stick to, you know, these formulas and these templates that are fashionable at the moment and that are being repeated by, you know, so many dozen TV series this year. You know, I can do something different, you know, I can, you know. Beyond that, it's a good question. I mean, I think I've said before that I do think that, even a film like Summer Wars, which was obviously made by the same studio, Madhouse, I do think that a figure like the grandmother, the great-grandmother in Summer Wars, who's a very vivid, strong character who goes through, shall we say, a surprising story arc. I do think that may owe something to some of the Satoshi Kon works and some of the characters, like, for example, the wife of the police officer in Paranoid Agents, or even Chiyoko, the time-traveling heroine in Millennium Actress, the kind of character-based storytelling, also particularly in Tokyo Godfathers, of course. This was something that Satoshi Kon moved forwards. I think I can see that maybe that influence may be in the films like Summer Wars. And again, I just hope that's something that is extended and developed as the years go by.
Yeah, I agree with that. I hope his lasting legacy will be simply inspiring new filmmakers to take risks and to follow in his footsteps, and
also, of course, not necessarily just in Japan. I mean, I would I would love to see an American filmmaker or a British filmmaker, whether in animation or live action. Of course, a lot of people would say that Darren Aronofsky already owes a great deal to Satoshi Kon. It would be great to see more filmmakers, Japanese or not, animated or not, you know, just taking their leads from Kon. I believe that Christopher Nolan, I think that one of the films that he saw was Paprika before he made this year's film Inception. There seems to be a French interview where he confirms that.
Oh, I thought he was asked about that in Los Angeles during a Q&A and said he had never seen it or something like that. I don't know. I honestly think that while I love Kon's work to death, I think his influence, like especially the Aronofsky stuff, it's overblown to me. I don't think Aronofsky needs to prove his creative bona fides or really got all that much inspiration from Kon's stuff. And I think he's an artist of near merit to Kon, I think, in my personal opinion. I just happen to love all of his movies, but except for The Fountain, which was a terrible film. But
of course, The Fountain has this weird parallel with Millennium Actress in that they're both about, characters desperately seeking lost loves across different realities and different eras. So there's this strange kind of parallel with Millennium Actress.
Sure, but one's watchable.
Yeah, the smell test for me on that is that I am a cinemaphile, and if I'm sitting watching an Aronofsky movie and at no point does it occur to me that this was influenced by Kon's films at all, I'm not going to agree with someone telling me, oh, he clearly this is taken from this Satoshi Kon movie. Sorry, you know, that would have occurred to me. I'm pretty good at picking that stuff up. And even the comparisons when people are like, oh, but look at this and look at that and look at this, they don't ring true to me at all.
One exception obviously being that one shot from Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, right. Like, you can get that. You can get, like, one or two little things, but it's not – I mean, okay, and I should filter this through the lens of the person who constantly antagonizes me about this is really annoying with it. And so now I'm full-blown, like, no, I don't even think he's ever seen a Satoshi Kon movie. Shut up
Please
and leave me alone.
Name names.
Oh, it's Daniel Zelter, man. He won't leave me the fuck alone about it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of obsession there, but
yeah, god damn. I eventually had to just tell him, like, I am done talking about this with you. I don't care anymore. And he finally let it go, but man, people just get rabid about that kind of thing. Like,
well, you know that you're going to start again now.
Oh yeah, well, of course. God damn it. Maybe I'll edit this out. but yeah, I mean, Justin, you have any thoughts on Kon's artistic legacy?
It's so early to say. Yeah. I can't think of anything yet because it's just too early. Anything that would have obviously been influenced by him, I don't think it would be out yet. Yeah. You know, aside from the earlier stuff like the Aronofsky stuff, but I think he left us with four great films and an interesting TV series, and that, you know, what more do you want?
Yeah. Let's see. Another Kon question from Chuo Dori says, where would you say that Kon felt most at home? As a director, as a writer, or as a mangaka? Well, I wouldn't say mangaka, because that was obviously the sort of least of his output.
Kind of abandoned that.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I'd have to say director, just because it seemed like that was his thing.
I think so. I mean, obviously for Kon, as for other directors, including Miyazaki, I think director and writer does blur together. Although actually, you know, it comes to think of it, of course, Kon, I think he's always worked with other writers. There are always other credited writers on his anime, I think. Although certainly for the films, I think it was Kon who always drew the storyboards, the Ekonte. But I think I think he would say that yes, he was most at home as a director. He seems fairly dismissive of his anime work, and he seems fairly dismissive of his manga work. And obviously, I don't think he hasn't done any manga for many, many years. Once he got into anime direction, so yes, I mean, I think he was counting himself as a director. Although for him, directing involved, you know, spending, you know, long, long hours drawing all the Ekonte, as well as, of course, he points out that he drew all of the kinds of little details in his movies, like a raindrop going down the windscreen in Paprika, or doing all the kinds of background posters, or even all the very vivid poster art for films like Perfect Blue. So he actually did a lot of stuff in his films, but I think he would call himself director.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Justin, any thoughts?
No.
Well, okay then.
Well, one thought, actually. I remember several times in more filmy circles, especially when it comes to, you know, auteurs casting judgment on the up-and-comers. One phrase that I hear that gets repeated a lot is something to the effect of, a director isn't worth his salt as a director if he can't write.
Yeah.
And although I don't entirely agree, if you take a step back and look at cinema history, most of the great auteurs also wrote their own works. It's just an inherent part of being being fully a storyteller in that medium. So I find it very hard to separate the two in my head.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And to wit, like, super mega successful, mega commercial Hollywood directors are not necessarily great storytellers, but they are extremely good at producing the product.
So, and, yeah, to wit, you could say they're more akin to the work for hire anime directors.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, in a way. All right, J.R. Nimanich asks, how are the UK European companies with communication with the press and consumers about releases and stuff?
Oh, they are, in my experience, they are very good. Yes, I mean, I have no complaint. I mean, I have no complaints. They all, I think, go out of their way to communicate as much as they can with the fan base, either through Twitter or through personal experience. Personal appearances at events such as the MCM Expos in London and the conventions around the country. I think they do make every effort, and often very strenuous, tiring efforts to be out there for the fans as much as they can and to communicate with the fans. Even if some of them occasionally get kind of visibly exasperated at certain types of fans and certain types of fan feedback.
Well, come on, who doesn't? You gotta give them a pass of some of the fans out there.
Indeed.
All right, and along those same, well, similar lines, V-Guy asks, has UK distribution recovered yet from when the main anime distribution warehouse was burned down in recent street anarchy?
Yes, well, I mean, that was the event that I referred to earlier. And the answer, the comments that I've heard have been upbeat. I mean, the comments were, we will recover, we will get over this. I've not heard an update recently. I've heard there may be consequences. I believe the distributor that was most affected was, Bees Entertainment, I think I'm right in saying. They were saying that there may be effects such as, for example, some of their older titles, they may not be able to kind of reprint or reissue them. It may be that some of their older titles really start disappearing or becoming kind of very rare commodities. There will be effects of that kind. Beyond that, I just don't know the latest bulletin, but the words I've heard has been kind of very sort of it's kind of very positive and we will get through this. I mean, that is the tone, and I'm inclined to believe them.
All right. Okay, and finally from Modern Rocker, our friend Corey Proft, how much do American buying trends affect UK licensing decisions, if at all? So, if Blue Exorcist sells really well, do you feel like that's a good indicator that it would also do okay in the UK?
I'm not really qualified to answer that question. I suppose just as a matter of common sense. Yeah, I mean, in most cases, if a title has been hugely popular in the American markets, then it's fair to say that it probably would do very well in the British markets as well, unless, obviously, it was a title that was around baseball or American football or something.
Well, those don't do well here either.
Well, there's a question. So, like, do football in the, you know, global term, football, do those do well in the UK?
No, I don't believe they do. I mean, I think sports anime is it may well be even more marginal in the British market than it is in the American market.
It's hard to imagine.
No, it's never done well.
Quick, we must have a rugby anime.
Oh, yes, we must have a rugby anime, yes.
I'll start pitching Cricket Chan. Yeah, that'll go over well. All right, well, that about...
I was watching. and of course, I'm sure Paranoid Agents has done good things for the junior baseball leagues, yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah, completely.
All right, well, hey, that about wraps it up. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. It was great fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Andrew for stopping by the show. The theme song is Bucharest by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave a review, a little rating. We appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.